Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, yes, you were promised a jetpack. Your disappointment around that may still sting, or you may be more concerned about global warming, or a robot taking your job, or finding affordable housing, or you might be reasonably concerned that the digital revolution will leave you somewhere on the global trash heap of history. A new book will help you find out what's happening now and next in technology, and maybe how to stay ahead of the curve. Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson are researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They've authored a series of books together, the latest of which is Machine, Platform, Crowd: Harnessing the Digital Revolution. They spoke with Microsoft computer scientist Ramez Nam at Town Hall Seattle on June 22nd. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. Regular listeners, please note, this is one of those events where it sounds like maybe seven people attended. You may have really wanted to be there, so enjoy this mind-blowing tour through a landscape of constant development and major imminent change. From the core to the crowd, the power of organizations, to that of individuals in a brave new economy. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Hello, everybody. I'm Ramez Nam. Many of you know me, and it's an honor and a pleasure to be here with my friends Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson. And we were just talking backstage. It was 3.5 years ago we met on this stage.
We met. Yeah. The friendship was initiated here at Town Hall in Seattle. Amazing. It's fantastic to be back. I'm serious about that.
Hopefully yeah. You guys make some friends tonight, too.
Yeah.
And it was because we were talking about your previous book, The Second Machine Age. So what's happened in the 3.5 years since The Second Machine Age?
Nothing much.
Yeah, exactly. Business as usual. Well, I mean, the main thing that happened, and it's a little bit embarrassing, is that tech progress continues to surprise the two of us, even after we wrote a book about surprisingly fast tech progress. Just weird things keep happening. And Eric and I kind of looked at each other at one point and said, hey, this continues to be extremely interesting. We continue to be extremely fascinated by this, and there's just more and more story to tell. So we went back out and talked to our favorite alpha geeks and wrote another book.
And the other half of it is, yeah, tech is happening faster, especially in the areas of machine learning, but also the rise of these platforms, and the core and crowd is a new thing we didn't really talk about before in the other book. But the other thing that is the disappointing half of it is that our organizations, our institutions are not keeping up. If anything, that's turned out even worse than we would have anticipated 3.5 years ago. So there's this mismatch, and we were hoping to try to do something, not to slow down the technology, but to speed up our adaptation to it.
Right, so Second Machine Age was really a book about the impact on society of these changes, and this is a book about how organizations can try to keep up with what's happening. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's a nice way to think about it.
Yeah, more specific, exactly.
So you have these three words in the title: machine, platform, crowd. Why don't we take it from the bottom? Like, can you walk through like crowd, platform, machine, what these all mean, why you're talking about them?
Now you're really throwing us off here.
But yeah.
I said, Andy was joshing me that I didn't want any prep. We're just going to get up here on stage. So I said I'd try to throw them some harder ones and try to confuse them a
but
little
we weren't expecting a crazy curveball like that. Like, we're very used to going machine, platform, crowd. We're deer in headlights with this. The way we're framing the book is in terms of three rebalancings or pretty deep rethinkings that need to happen within organizations. And with crowd, we counterpose the crowd, which is literally these hundreds of millions of random weirdos out there on the internet, with the core, with what organizations think they're really, really good at. And we kept on coming across these crazy examples of what organizations thought they were really, really good at. The instant you give them an honest head-to-head comparison or competition between what their core can come up with versus what the crowd can come up with, the crowd eats their lunch. The crowd just mops the floor with what the best people of the core can come up with. And so we found all these fascinating examples of that, and it's worth diving into and figuring out how and why is the crowd so powerful.
Can you give us an example? What's a scenario where the crowd did better than the core of a company?
Well, here's a good one that just got launched today. I was just reading as I was coming over here, just before I was coming over here, there's an organization called Kaggle. Anybody familiar with Kaggle? So this is an organization that's brought together 1 million data scientists. And the U.S. government has just asked them to run a contest to figure out better ways to speed up airport screening, to identify things more efficiently and speed the process. They have a $1.5 million prize.
Can anyone here think of a more important thing to do?
Exactly. And the reason that they went to Kaggle is that, as Andy was saying, you know, there's some pretty smart people working in Homeland Security, people who they could hire from, you know, from Harvard or MIT or UW or wherever. But instead of just picking a few core people to work on this, they want to tap into that a million plus data scientists. And as Andy was saying, when they do that, they get answers just out of left field. One of the reasons that the crowd works so well is not just that there's a bunch of people, but more importantly, that there's a lot of diversity of people. Any organization, no matter how good it is, most of the smart people work outside of that organization. Furthermore, in the organization, people tend to get groupthink. They sort of start thinking the same ways. They hire people similar to them. But what makes these contests successful is that there's some very new approaches, techniques, algorithms that people are doing in Ireland or Bangalore or Norway or wherever that the people in the core hadn't been familiar with. And those can sometimes make a 10 or 20 or 50% improvement in the performance, and sometimes even a few 100% improvement.
One of the weirdest examples we came across that made it into the book, you know who our buddy Kareem Lakhani is at Harvard Business School. He's one of our colleagues, does great research about how to tap into the crowd.
He's at Harvard, we're at MIT, but we claim him because he got his PhD at MIT.
He got brought up proper is what I'm trying to say. So Kareem worked with the National Institutes of Health to try to see if they could improve over the baseline NIH algorithm for sequencing human white blood cells, which have really weird genomes, so you got to do some clever work on it. The baseline algorithm from the NIH could do this work in about 4 hours with about 70% accuracy. Is that good? Is that bad? National Institutes of Health. Yeah, I mean, okay, that's the National Institutes of Health. You'd think that's kind of a good baseline to work from. There's a researcher at Harvard Medical School, also kind of the core of the medical establishment, who got it down from 4 hours to 1 hour and got it up to about 75% accuracy. Okay, that's better. Then Kareem worked with TopCoder in this case, another crowdsourced tough problem site, and threw this problem open to all the random weirdos out there on the internet. And the best solutions that came from the random weirdos of the internet did the work in 10 seconds and did it at about 80% accuracy, which they thought was close to the theoretical maximum here. And when they went and interviewed the people who submitted those solutions, there was not one person with life sciences experience among them. Most of them were students. They were all from fields very, very far away. So the fancy word for some of the secret sauce here is marginality. If what if your expertise is marginal or kind of far away from the apparent domain of the problem, chances of solving actually go up. You know Eric Raymond's law, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. There's a lot of eyeballs out there.
It's amazing. 4 hours to 10 seconds.
Yeah. Kareem wrote this paper up, and Eric and I read it, and I called him up immediately. I said, he's a friend of mine, so I said, dude, is this the craziest thing you've ever seen? And he said, it's about average. I said, come on. He said, if I run a competition, a fair crowd competition, and I don't see this magnitude of improvement from the crowd, I think I've done my work incorrectly.
So what stops more and more companies from actually taking advantage of this ability to tap into the crowd?
They haven't read the book yet. But I'm only half joking. It honestly is, I mean, the technology is there. This is a cultural change. This is a mindset change. It was something that you just couldn't do. You physically couldn't do this a decade or two ago. We now, for the first time, have the majority of the world's population, the majority of the world's brains, connected in a global internet and able to share information like this more or less instantaneously. That hasn't always been true in history. That's never been true before. And not only can they tap into that data, more importantly, they can add to that data. So people are just now discovering new, clever ways to tap into the crowd. These contests are only one way. Wikipedia is another way.
You have a great story about Nupedia that preceded Wikipedia and how it changed.
Yeah, well, that's a good example. So Nupedia was kind of the old thinking of how you make an encyclopedia. You have some experts, and you go through this seven-step process where you vet it, and blah, blah, blah. They got a bunch. Jimmy Wales, the guy who did start Wikipedia, first started Nupedia. They got a few hundred thousand dollars worth of funding. They worked on it for a year. At the end of the year, I think they had, what, like 12 articles done, something like that.
So this is a 1,000% true story. How many of you have heard of Newpedia?
There you go.
This was the direct predecessor founded by the exact same people as Wikipedia. They wanted to make sure only experts could edit articles. They had a seven-step process that everyone had to go through, and the world said, yeah, no, thank you.
But then they sort of has this little skunkworks thing. Some people say, you know, there's this new, you know, type of software, wikis. You could just kind of throw stuff up real quickly. Why don't we just let people just kind of play around with that? And so they let people, anybody could just sort of play around with it. And you know the rest of the story. People started writing articles like crazy. Soon they had 1,000 articles. Soon they had 10,000 articles. And then Jimmy Wales' company said, wait a minute. What are we doing with this Newpedia thing? We got to do the Wikipedia option. And now it's become, you know, the resource. So that's another way that you're able to tap into a crowd. But it's a mindset change to understand that you can tap into this. And one of the things we want to see more and more is people being creative about other ways to tap into the crowd. You know, Google, the power of Google, when you think about it, is really tapping into the crowd. Yeah, they've got some super smart engineers in Mountain View and elsewhere, but how do they rank the pages? There's something called PageRank, and it's based on the link structure and where those links come from. Everybody in the crowd decides what pages to link to. And when you link to a page, when you write a web page and you link to others, you are voting. And so basically what Google is doing is taking the collective wisdom of the crowd, all the votes that different pages get, and the ones with more votes get up to the top of the search rankings. So they are leveraging our collective thinking.
Mez, your question is one that Eric and I grappled with a lot in the book. Why is it so hard for successful, incumbent, established, well-managed companies to see these possibilities? And like Eric says, the idea of crowdsourcing your toughest problems went from actually inconceivable, this is extraordinarily hard to do 20 years ago, to kind of cognitively inconceivable, even though the technology environment changes really quickly. So the mantra that I've adopted as we wrote this book was that tech progress rewrites the business playbook. And a lot of even very good companies get stuck in the old version of the playbook.
So we talk about collective intelligence, and these are awesome examples. But we've seen some failures recently, right? We've seen harassment and hate on Twitter. We've seen fake news on Facebook.
Yes.
Maybe the filter bubble. Collective intelligence seeming to go down rat holes. Does that make you rethink your thesis at all?
I think this is a powerful tool, and any powerful tool can be used for good or evil. And yeah, let's compare. You know, Facebook, Twitter, Wikipedia, they all harness the crowd in different ways. They have slightly different structures. And Wikipedia, even the first time, they didn't get the fine-tune it quite right. Wikipedia tends to have a lot less fake news. And actually, we were talking to Jimmy Wales about this. And he, you know, he thinks, I'm convinced, that a lot of it has to do with the fine structure of how you set it up. And that the way Facebook was set up, it's very prone to these filter bubbles. You share stuff with your friends, and your friends aren't inclined to fact-check it. At Wikipedia, there are these editors, you don't know who they are, and they take it upon themselves to fact check it. They're not your buddies. They're not there to, like, say, rah, rah, more of the, you know, go Obama, go Trump, whatever. They have a very different perspective. And by depending on how you set it up, you get different outcomes. One of the things that we're collectively doing is experimenting with different ways of structuring it. And sometimes we mess up, and, you know, you talk to Mark Zuckerberg, and I think he'd be among the first to say, they messed up big time in 2016. At first, they thought, "Hey, it's not our responsibility." They say, "We're like selling a pencil, and if someone writes bad words with a pencil, that's not our responsibility." And they were sticking to that line for a while, and now they've backed off. They say, "You know what? No, that's not right at all. That's not the right model."
One thing that I think we've learned in 2016 and 2017 is that free speech is a bummer. Right? Because we are actually giving, there's the old great quote from the journalist A.J. Liebling. He said, freedom of the press is limited to those who own one. Okay. Hey, everybody, we got a printing press now. And so do the Nazis and the racists and the anti-Semites and the trollers and the haters. And that echo chamber can make these environments filthy, filthy places. So I have not walked away from my devotion to free speech, but I'm going to segue and talk about another chunk of our book now. We kind of think that a big part of the solution to this weakness of the crowd are actually machines. And what I mean by that are machine learning algorithms that can recognize vitriolic speech, terrorist speech, stuff like that, do that very sophisticated pattern matching and yank it down, in addition to these architectural changes that Eric talked about, so that you can reconfigure things so that the echo chamber doesn't echo quite as
but
loud.
At the end of the day, I think more and more the limiting thing, and one of the things we stress in the book, is figuring out our institutions and the organizational side of it is where I think there's been a bigger and bigger gap. And it's great that the technologists are working on the machine algorithms and the ways to tap into the crowd, but the biggest bottleneck and the biggest gap is figuring out how to use them more effectively, the economic principles underlying, the organizational principles underlying. And that's a big part of why we wrote the book, was to try to lay out that this is not just random chaos out there or the luck of the draw. There are some underlying principles that can work.
This is actually where I disagree with Eric a little bit. I'm a bigger fan of using the machines instead of the institutions on this one. Everything that you and I see on Facebook and a lot of these other platforms has been teed up for us by a machine learning algorithm. Great. Tweak those to damp the stupidity and the hatred and the echoing.
So you both have hope that this filter bubble can get better, and you would use machines to assess truthiness, and you would change the incentives or the structure of Facebook to change.
Well, I think we do both. Yeah. Maybe we'd put the emphasis differently. And we don't have faith. I wouldn't quite use that word.
Hope.
Optimism.
I think that there's the potential for it, but it's very much going to depend on our choices, and it's certainly not going to be automatic. And the last thing I'd want to do is just sit back and say, hey, don't worry, it's all going to work out. That would be totally the wrong attitude.
Totally.
So since we're talking about Facebook, let's dive into what it is, which is it's a platform. So you talk about a change from businesses selling products to businesses creating platforms that soak up a lot of that value. What's happening there?
Well, create a lot of that value. Great. So five of the five most valuable companies in the world are basically platform companies. Two of them here in Seattle, Microsoft and Amazon, but also Facebook, Google, Alphabet, and Apple. And what they have in common is not that they create some great products, but more importantly that they enable an ecosystem. They create a platform for other people to contribute to that. And so whether it's Apple's apps that people are contributing or in other ways, and these platforms scale as more and more people participate in them. They have network effects, or even more subtly, we get into the book, two-sided network effects. You're all familiar with the basic network effect, which is like the value of a telephone goes up if other people own the telephone. If no one else has a telephone, it's not very valuable, or a fax machine or whatever. So that's a network effect, that more people using the same product is more valuable. A two-sided network is a little more subtle, but it's when people are using a other side of the network, a complement. For instance, Uber is another kind of a platform that took off very quickly. What they were able to do is create one app for users, and there's actually a different app that the drivers use. And as a user, I don't really care if lots of other users are using it. I want more drivers to be on it. And what the drivers care about is not having lots of drivers. They want to have people on the other side. And the platform is able to connect these two sides in different ways. Facebook is connecting advertisers and the users. And each of these, and Apple is actually a multi-sided network where you've got the different kinds of apps, the users, Apple's on the iPhones, and the more people that participate in any one of those sides, the more valuable it is to the other parts of it. So this concept of these multi-sided networks is driven in part by the digitization that we referred to earlier, these underlying technologies. It's also driven by some new economics that people really didn't understand very well. One of our colleagues, Jean Tirole, got a Nobel Prize a few years ago for really working.
He never shuts up about it either. It's really annoying.
Actually, Jean is like one of the most modest.
He's one of the nicest guys.
Nicest laid back guys.
Low-key guys in the world.
So on the record.
Despite being French.
He went there, and
he's a very sweet guy. And he worked this out. There's some beautiful, elegant math. Some of our other colleagues, like Marshall Van Alstyne, helped contribute to it. And what we try and do in the book is say, look, these platforms aren't just accidents that just pop up. That if you understand the economics, you can see sometimes it makes sense to give stuff away for free and then you make money on the other side of the network. It's not always a good idea to give stuff away for free. You should just do it willy-nilly. But if you understand the platform economics, you can see when it is a profitable strategy.
And Eric just did a really nice job of walking through those economics. My favorite part when we were writing the section on platforms was highlighting how no less an authority on all things digital than Steve Jobs very nearly blew this.
Right. I love this story.
This is an actual true story. When Jobs introduced the iPhone.
All our stories are true stories.
A decent fraction of our stories are true stories. So the iPhone came out just about a little more than 10 years ago, January of 2007. And when it was introduced, some of us are probably old enough to remember this, all of the apps that were available for the iPhone were developed by Apple. And that was not an accident. That was an adamant, deliberate strategy by Steve Jobs. Jobs was a control freak, and he didn't want random, crashy, buggy, virusy kinds of things mucking up his beautiful iPhone. He had colleagues on the board. He had executives inside the company who tried to persuade him of some of the economics that Eric just talked about, and said, look, open this platform up, and you're going to unleash a whole lot of energy. And Jobs was like, nope. And it took about a year and a half of convincing for him to do it. Apple finally opened up the iPhone store. It was called iTunes back then. Opened up iTunes to outside developers of the iPhone in July of 2008. And just like with Wikipedia, they came back a half hour later and there were 6,000 articles. They came back a day later and there were 400 amazing apps available for the iPhone. And it's one of the few times that I think Jobs ever came anywhere near close to admitting that he'd been anything less than faultless about something.
So you're saying Steve Jobs did not want me to have Angry Birds?
No, not unless his people came up with Angry Birds.
He learned.
This is true.
It doesn't seem like a very Apple product, Angry Birds.
Yeah.
So when you look at these platforms, it seems that there's, in most of them, because of the network effects, there's a winner-takes-all dynamic, or winner leaves for one or two or three winners totally. Does that concern you as far as monopolizing power or lack of innovation or stagnation?
The guideline that I try to follow is that all great concentrations of power demand vigilance, and we need to be mindful of them and watch out for them and try to make sure that they're not abusing that power or doing things that we don't like, right? To me, that's different than saying that all great concentrations of power need to be broken up. And here's a flip analogy. America is a great concentration of power. I am not about to commit treason here on this stage. I am not advocating that we break up the United States government. So in the same way, I will worry a lot more about the power that these platform companies have. And these are really powerful companies, and we need to be vigilant. I'll worry more about them when I get clear evidence that either innovation is being squelched or that we consumers are being harmed.
And Andy just hit on the two key tests for good antitrust. I mean, when a competitor becomes very, very powerful, its competitors get angry and they say, hey, we've got to stop these guys. We at Walmart are having trouble competing with Amazon or whatever. And
boo-hoo-hoo
it's understandable
Walmart,
that they would say that and marshal as much anger in that direction. But the regulators and the rest of us, we shouldn't be worrying about the competitors. We should be worrying about the consumers or about the innovation. And on both those fronts, so far, these companies are pushing prices down, even to the point of free for a lot of them. And I don't see like a lack of innovation in the app economy or social media. It looks like it's still going pretty strong, stronger than in these other places. Now, if that changes, yeah. I'm totally with Andy. You know, we need to be vigilant. And if when Amazon bought Whole Foods, they got about 4% of the grocery market. You know, if that gets to be 60%, and they start raising prices, then I would change the story. But the other thing that gives me some, confidence and maybe willingness to sit back a little bit is another economist, I love quoting economists, Joseph Schumpeter. So he was a great Austrian economist, and he came up with this concept of creative destruction. And the way he described a capitalist successful economy working was, yes, you get monopolies, but then another monopoly overtakes it, and another monopoly overtakes it. So you get companies that become dominant for a while, but if they don't keep innovating, someone else can innovate it. So there was once VisiCalc, and then Lotus, and then Excel, and and each of them, they got overtaken. They had big, 70% market shares for a while, and eventually, Windows just became more or less irrelevant as the iPhone and other tools became more pertinent. So that's what I see a lot more of happening in this tech economy. Is absolutely, you get these monopolies, but they're, as long as they're temporary and they're subject to challenge,
that's right.
Then
exactly.
It's less of a concern.
And one of the classic things that a monopolist does that we need to watch out for is price gouge. Kind of hard for Google and Facebook to price gouge us when they give it away for free.
That's a pretty low price.
That's, I think.
So,
it doesn't hurt, right? It doesn't feel like I'm being gouged.
Yeah. So you have some advice or some analysis of what leads to a company being successful in building a platform. So if there's entrepreneurs here who want to get into a new space, let's say, that isn't monopolized already, what would you tell them to do to try to establish themselves successfully?
Again, there's a book.
Step one.
What we try to do in the middle section of the book is go through the economics that Eric just went through a second ago in a bit more detail to talk about why two-sided or N-sided markets work, why you would drop prices for one side versus the other, which side you would pick, and kind of do all that. At the same time, so I think the economics are at the core of all these successful platform companies that we learned about and that we think are really, really cool. At the same time, we found a couple other things they seem to do really well. One of them is focus obsessively on the user interface and the user experience, which is hard to do on a very small amount of real estate. You're trying to cram in a lot of functionality. So all the platform companies that we talk to work like crazy on getting that stuff right. And they A-B test, and they've got really smart people on it. And then the other thing they do is they just draw in data geeks from economics and operations research and yield management and stuff like that, and they cram a whole lot of math and algorithms and matching inside the ecosystem that they build.
Yeah, and what they do, if they do it right, they get a virtuous cycle going, or I guess the term of art these days is flywheel going, where you get a few more users on one side, then you get more on the other side, and becomes a positive feedback loop. But getting that ignited, getting that started, can be very difficult. So if you can find a way that can work with very small numbers of users, or just a lead user, then you can ignite that virtuous cycle. And if it gets going, it can take off very rapidly, and it becomes, like you said, often a winner-take-all market or winner-take-most market. Venture capitalists love that, because if you can be out in front and they're willing to invest to try to get you into that lead. But you also got to be careful, because the same thing can unravel. If you start getting into a vicious cycle where it goes the opposite way, it can all come undone pretty quickly, too.
We got a great example of exactly how to do this just 2 days ago. We had a book event in San Francisco. We invited some of our alpha geeks to come talk with us on stage. And one of them is Patrick Collison, co-founder of Stripe. Stripe is a payments company founded by these two Irish kids. And I'm using the word correctly. Patrick and John Collison were 21 and 19 years old, respectively, when they founded this company to take on the established payments industry around the world.
Take on the banking industry.
What the heck were you thinking? But they're really very, very smart, thoughtful, great entrepreneurs. And Patrick said, look, we realized that if we could build a payments platform and more merchants would show up and then more kinds of payment would show up and then we'd have different countries and we could get this virtuous cycle going. But at the start, it had to do something for a customer that we were interested
in. Even just one.
And he said, look, the one thing we could do for an online merchant from the get-go was accept a credit card. Just like help them process those kinds of payments. And that was enough of a toehold, and they did other clever things, and they got the virtuous cycle going.
Okay, and maybe Uber, if they're not lucky enough, might be at the start of a vicious cycle.
Well, that's Uber, there's a couple lessons there. Obviously, their culture has some serious problems, but the fact that they had such powerful two-sided network effects in this platform, I think that sustained them through a less than optimal culture. But it's not unstoppable. You could easily see it coming out. And what we've seen the past couple of months is that their market share has started turning downward and Lyft going up. So you could be seeing something really ugly if it gets to a certain point.
Yeah, running a dysfunctional kind of ugly corporate culture is a terrible idea in this day and age and all previous ones.
Excellent. Even if you've got a strong platform. We can all applaud to that one.
We can all get behind that idea.
So let's go to Machine. I saved this for last. This is your previous book was The Second Machine Age. Yep. You talked about AI and machine learning and amazing feats. What's happened just in that sector in the last 3.5 years? What's gotten better?
Well, the biggest thing, and by the way, we all of our books so far, this is the third book we've written, they all have the word machine in it. So we really are obsessing about
the theme.
This. And we pay close attention. And the biggest thing has just been the amazing progress in machine learning. We touched on it in the last book, but certainly us two, but even the geeks working in machine learning didn't expect it to advance as rapidly as it has. And we sometimes call this the second wave of the second machine age, in that a lot of the stuff in the last book was about how technology we could teach machines how to do things. Now machines are learning on their own, and they've gotten to the point where they're crossing some real significant thresholds. For instance, vision systems that learn on their own how to recognize faces or cancer cells or other objects are now getting to the point where they are not just as good, but even better than human vision at recognizing those same things. Sound systems or voice recognition systems are beginning to recognize speech at that point. The error rate on Google Home went from 8.5% to 4.9%, not in the past 10 years, but in the past 10 months. And that's because of these deep neural net systems. It's a certain branch of machine learning where you feed it lots of examples and it learns. And the people working in the field say that we're just in early days. This is going to improve more and more. And this technique of deep neural net supervised learning, they can apply it to lots of other areas that previously hadn't been applied to before. So we think that there are some huge impacts that are happening on business, on the economy, on the workforce, as you cross that threshold. I mean, think about it. If something goes from being worse than human to better than human, then that's not just a difference in degree, that's a difference in kind. If you are an entrepreneur or a manager, you're going to pick, you know, whatever tool, whatever resource, whatever person is best for that job. And if it goes from being a human to a machine, that's going to change the calculus in lots and lots of businesses or across America and across the world.
I find it hard to overstate how big a deal this is. We are no longer limited by our own knowledge. We can build machines that do better than us, that exceed our own knowledge. And that sounds like some kind of trippy sci-fi thing. It's already happened a couple times. A lot of us are probably aware that the world's best player of the Asian strategy game Go is now a piece of technology, right? We kind of knew that. That piece of technology is not just playing Go better than the best human players. It's playing differently than the best human players. It made moves in some of these very high-level matches that were inexplicable at the time. Nobody commenting or watching the match would know why the machine made that move, because it violated about 3,000 years of accumulated human knowledge about how to play this game. Those moves turned out to be the right ones. How do we know? The machine won the game. And the current Chinese champion of Go, who's a phenomenally talented player, went on their equivalent of Twitter a little while back, and he said, after he had played AlphaGo, he said, "I don't think a single human has touched the edge of the truth of the game of Go. We played this game, we invented this game, we played it for 3,000 years, we got up to this level." And it kind of reminds me of the algorithm, like of the NIH. How good is this? How much headroom is on top of this? And AlphaGo seems to be saying, gang, there's a lot of headroom on top of this. And so I think about these other incredibly complicated, incredibly, you know, rich domains where we'd like to be smart, whether that's material science or investing or genetics. And we're not the only game in town. We have a colleague that can help us. And I think in a lot of domains, our knowledge is here, and we're going to see a lot of headroom opening up. I'm really excited about that.
So just to riff off what you're saying that AI, machine learning, could be the best scientist at designing new materials. It could be the best doctor at diagnosing a disease for medical imagery.
Yeah.
It could be the best engineer for designing a new airplane part.
I want to be clear, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, and already is in a lot of those. So there have been, you know, published papers in Nature, our friend Sebastian Lund published one, where a machine learning algorithm did a better job diagnosing cancer. We were talking to our friend Carl Bass, who used to be the CEO of Autodesk, and he was showing these trippy objects that had been designed by machines. There's a heat exchanger, and it looked really beautiful, kind of psychedelic. It had some delicate curves to it. He said no human would have designed a heat exchanger.
Unless they were really high, I think is what Carl actually said.
But then it
said.
Wouldn't have worked.
Right, and then it would not exchange
heat. And
this
one completely exceeded anything that any of the people had designed. So these are not like someday maybe we'll
That's
see
right.
this. These are physical objects that have been created. These are actual diagnoses that have been done by machine learning algorithms.
Now, can I do one more thing? Because one question that we always get when this question comes up is, oh my God, Skynet, right? People just immediately think about the Terminator or the Matrix or some kind of scary superintelligence coming because of these developments. And when Eric and I go talk to the alpha geeks who are making these technologies, they are just dismissive of this possibility. And what they say is, look, we're solving incredibly tough engineering problems. We're throwing a whole lot of math and a whole lot of computation and a whole lot of data at things. That's all we're doing. We don't know how the brain works. We don't know what consciousness is. We're not plumbing those mysteries. We're banging away on this really kind of super important but constrained set of problems over here. I don't think they're lying to us.
You would think that.
That's true. That's true. I'm gullible that so way. Right.
The hospital information system is not going to suddenly become self-aware and decide to take over.
No. You know, the line that I use, which I said for the first time in 2013, and it still works, is I will start worrying about that when my computer spontaneously decides to talk to my printer.
Awesome. You have a section when you're talking about this. You're talking about going back before this, before the computer not, Skynet not arriving from our toasters, that you talk about the old deal between machines and minds. You're talking about rebalancing, machine to mind, crowd to core, platform to product.
Yeah.
And you talk about the old balance being the machines did all the rote work, all the just like the number crunching and so on, but humans exercise all the judgment.
Yeah.
Is that changing?
It damn well better, right? We're going to do a quick experiment here, and I mean this seriously. I'm going to ask you three questions, and I want you to give yourself a number from 1 to 100. 1 being I'm absolutely, absolutely, abjectly terrible at this. 100 being I'm the best that there could possibly be at this. So here are three questions, and just mentally give yourself three numbers. Don't shout them out. Compared to the folk around me, I have good judgment. Compared to the folk around me, I make good predictions. Compared to the folk around me, I am a good judge of character. You have three numbers in your head? Here's the last bit of the assignment. Average them. Don't have to be 2 decimal points of accuracy. Average them. Everybody have a number? Raise your hand if your number is above 50. Way up in the air. Yeah, gang, no more than half the hands should be up in the air. So we're just super fond of our judgment, and there's way too much evidence. Our judgment is awesome, but it is biased and buggy and flawed, and it's really easy to beat our judgment with just a little bit of objective evidence and a little bit of math.
And so you're saying in these domains, some that are that we think of as being not just about business, but judgment in the legal sense, for instance, that we'd be better off using algorithms to decide who gets parole.
Well, yeah, exactly. There have been studies of this, and there's a fascinating study of Israeli judges, and the main thing that determined whether or not someone got parole or not was not the facts of the case, it was whether or not that judge had had a meal recently. So if the judge had low blood sugar, you were very unlikely to get parole. But if you were lucky enough to go just after breakfast or just after lunch, your odds went way, way up. So these were patterns that showed up repeatedly. It was peer-reviewed, carefully studied, and this has been found in lots of other situations that we are just subject to all sorts of biases in our decision-making. And there's a Nobel Prize. Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky got Nobel Prizes for pointing out these kinds
of... Not Tversky. He was dead.
Yeah, that's right. These biases in decision-making that happen, they're like blind spots. We're all familiar with the visual blind spots, but we have the same kind of blind spots in our mental decision-making. And so there's room to use algorithms to make better decisions. And one of the other things that's sweeping, in addition to artificial intelligence, that's sweeping the country and the world is more data-driven decision-making, shifting from using human judgment to more data-driven decisions. And so, for instance, the number of companies that, by our criteria, have become data-driven has increased by about threefold over the past 5 years. It's become much more data-driven. And the companies that are data-driven have about 5% better productivity than the companies that aren't data-driven.
The parole, the dysfunctions of the parole decision are so widely accepted now that a lot of states have actually gone toward algorithmic scoring for parole. This notion that I'm going to look into your eyes and know if you're a reformed criminal or not, give me a break. There's just way too much evidence it doesn't work very well.
And again, part of the reason that this didn't happen before was we just didn't have the data.
We didn't
have the ability or techniques. So, you know, it used to be that for thousands of years, the way important decisions were made in organizations, companies, kingdoms, whatever, is people would sit around and talk, they'd all give their opinions, and then when it was time to make a decision, they would go with the hippo. And the HIPAA, anybody heard that acronym before? An acronym we've used in some of our writing. It's an acronym for the highest paid person's opinion. So basically, that's what you ended up using as the decision-making criteria. You went around, and then whoever had the highest pay, their opinion would rule. But that's because you had no other data, no other way of judging. But as Jim Clark once said, you know, if we have data, we're going to go with the data. If all we have is opinions, we'll go with mine.
How many of you have seen a bad decision made based on the highest paid person's opinion?
Okay. And we should be clear. Algorithms make some stupid, have some weird, stupid outcomes too. What Eric and I are not saying is give every decision of any consequence over to the technology and don't ever second guess it. That's a really scary way to proceed.
Mez, you said exactly right. These are three rebalancings. And while we are enthusiasts for the power of machines, the power of platforms, the power of the crowd, we absolutely are clear in the book that it's not like you turn the dial all the way to max on each of those. You have to understand where the trade-offs are.
There seems to be a recent backlash a bit against algorithmic decision-making, people complaining that the algorithms might be trained on bad data, that they might have their own biases, that we don't know what's in the algorithms, who's controlling them. What do you say about that?
That's absolutely legit. And in particular, if you train an algorithm on a set of data that only has one segment of the population, you're going to not do a very good job with other segments of the population. So no one in machine learning that we talk to is unaware of this problem. And so they work really hard on training these things. There's another complaint which you brought up, which is we don't know what's in the algorithms. Gang, we don't know what's between our ears either. And when we use Danny Kahneman's language in the book about system one and system two, system one is this really fast, instinctual, snap judgment thing. System two is the slow, deliberative, rational. We all walk around thinking that because we're evolved human beings, system two kind of carries the day and it can override this lizard braid system one. That's actually about 180 degrees backward. And what we know from way too much evidence is that what really happens, the imagery that I love, is that system two, this rational deliberative thing, is a very high paid lawyer drafted by system one to get system one's will done out there in the world. So it's an explainer module, not the actual decider module.
People call it, psychologists call it confabulation. You will come up with a reason for doing something no matter whether or not you realize it or not, and that's part of what System 2 does. But you do hit on some important points. It is certainly possible for and common for these algorithms to have hidden biases in them, and it usually comes not because the people who design the algorithms have some ill intent. It's as Andy said, it's from the training data. And if the training data is trained on, who should we give loans to? Let's look at who our loan officers gave loans to. And if the loan officers had biases, subtle biases, those are going to be picked up in the training data, and the algorithm is going to have those biases. Yeah. But it could be problematic because it's very unlikely that the algorithm, or it's certain that the algorithm is not going to have a rule in there that says, don't give loans to black people or whatever the biases is. It's going to be much more subtle because many of these neural nets have upwards of 1 billion interconnections and weights, and trying to sort out what exactly is going on in those billion interconnections and weights is basically impossible. They cannot explain it to us. We can't properly explain to each other. The reason that I think Andy and I both have some pushback on a little bit on the anger against the algorithms is that we have the potential to improve them over time. And I think that there's more room to test. And the algorithm will come up with the same recommendation given the same amount of the same data. And then you can tweak it and you can see what kinds of mistakes it may be making. And once you improve it, you can have sustained improvements over time. That's a lot harder to do with humans. It's much harder to even understand where the biases of humans are and get them to overcome their own biases.
For example, if you give an experienced clinician, a medical clinician, the same information about a patient over the space, and you wait about 24 or 48 hours, they will agree with themselves about 65% of the time, no more than that. That's not a failure mode that the algorithms have, but the algorithms are just god-awful stupid about what's happening out there in the world. They deeply lack common sense. We have a ton of that. And what Eric and I are excited about is if you bring together minds and machines properly, you don't double down on the errors. You can cancel each other's errors out.
Yeah. So how do you do that? How would you put mind and machine together in these judgment scenarios?
Let me give you a couple of examples. One is exactly in sort of looking at data diagnoses. A lot of these algorithms, They can be tuned and be very good at detecting cancer, but they often make too many false positives. They say, hey, this looks like cancer, and it really isn't. Humans are actually better at ruling those out. So many of the systems that people put in place will do them sequentially. The machine will bring to the attention, this is something that looks concerning. Instead of these 1,000 places you could look or these 10,000 places you look, just look at these 20. Mm. And then the human focuses their attention on the ones that are concerning and maybe rules some in and some out. Another example is one that I think we may all be able to relate to a little bit more, is the sales process. Our friend Sebastian Thrun runs a company called Udacity. Anybody here know Udacity, familiar with that? It's an online teaching course. And they get a lot of incoming traffic from people through chat rooms saying, hey, is this course right? Should I be doing this? What do you think? Should I be taking this? And they have highly trained, really good salespeople who respond back in these chat rooms, rapid-fire answering questions. Some of them are better than others. And what Sebastian and his student realized was that, hey, all these transcripts of all of our conversations with customers and potential customers are training data for an algorithm. Let's teach the algorithm which conversations lead to sales and which ones don't lead to sales. And by looking at examples, sales, not sales, sales, not sales, it eventually starts certain patterns or certain kinds of things, information you can provide, ways you can phrase things that are more likely to convert a potential customer. But instead of trying to build an uber amazing bot that would be able to answer all of the questions that people came in that was sort of artificially intelligent at that level, they built one that just gave advice or suggestions to the human salespeople, especially to those not so good, the 50% that were below average. And every organization has 50% of the people that are below average, sadly.
Hard truth.
Another hard truth. So what it would do is as the questions came in, it would notice some patterns and say, you know, you might want to give them this piece of information, or you might want to phrase it this way. And over time, the humans got better, but they would get this prompting. And it increased the throughput by about 50% and the conversion rate by over 20%. So that was a good example of humans and machines working together to have better performance than either of them could have separately.
Okay. Last topic before we open it up to all of you for questions. If the computer is going to be so good at diagnosing disease, at helping us with sales, maybe doing it one day, what are we going to do?
Right, read science fiction novels.
Thank you.
Write and read science fiction novels. The important thing to keep in mind is that technology is encroaching on stuff that we used to need all of us for. That's absolutely true, and Eric and I think that encroachment is going to continue and it's going to accelerate, and that can be a terrifying vision for a lot of people. The thing to keep in mind is that there is no shortage of work to be done. There is no shortage of work to be done that is for a long time to come, even with crazy tech progress, still needs to be done by human beings. And a couple different categories of that are work that requires compassion, or work that requires tapping into social drives, work that requires dealing with other human bodies. We're so blobby and weird, the robots are not very good at that stuff yet. My mom, unfortunately, is in a rehab facility. I think she'd want me to specify that it's a physical rehab facility. And the surgeon that worked on her back, and then the physical therapists who are helping her regain her function, these are not going to be replaced by robots anytime soon. I can vouch for that firsthand. We need to take care of little kids. We have sick people. We have lonely elderly people. That is work that is human work to be done. If we could actually decide that we wanted to have an infrastructure in this country that was better than a D-plus grade, the robots are not repairing bridges and airports yet. So that's hard, good old-fashioned, you know, brawny hard hat work for America. We can continue to go down the list. There's just no shortage of work to be done.
I mean, the thing to keep in mind in terms of the big picture is technology's always been destroying jobs, but it's also always been creating jobs. And there's this turnover. We're concerned because it's happening at a faster pace. It's a broader swath of things. But we are very far from having machines be able to do everything. I don't doubt that maybe someday that will happen. But the problem we're facing right now is not the end of work. It's a big dislocation, a transference of work. And the advice I would give is look for things that machines can't do well. And Andy hit on two of the big categories. One are interpersonal skills, emotional intelligence, caring, compassion, coaching, motivating, teamwork, leadership, all of those sort of human skills. The other big category is creative work. And I mean like large scale, complicated, writing novels, coming up with scientific discoveries, being an entrepreneur and conceiving of a whole new way of organizing people and products and customers. Those kinds of large-scale creative tasks, machines can't do well at all. In fact, there's probably no better time in history to be a talented entrepreneur or a person with any kind of talent that is scalable with these machines. It's a time when you can just affect the world to a far greater extent than you ever could before. So there's room for ways that we can do a lot better. And I think it's way premature to sort of be talking about, let's put everybody on, you know, basic income or whatever and give up on work. I think there's so much work that needs to be done and that can be done only by humans. We just have to help make that transition happen.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson are researchers at MIT. They've authored a series of books together, the latest of which is Machine Platform Crowd, Harnessing the Digital Revolution. They spoke with Microsoft computer scientist Ramez Nam at Town Hall Seattle on June 22nd. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full talk and Q&A on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.